Okay. Keep going, Jonathan. We'll do the intro after.
So what I was saying is this idea of we're all a lot of people are trying to attach to their higher self or connect to it. And I think that's like a general, not a general, it's a common desire is to think, to get to this big spiritual realm. And this is where we come from, maybe a difference from the traditional alchemical view is not, and then the spiritual view, right? Spirit is all about connecting to that higher self. Whereas the alchemical view is about going deep inside and feeling those transformations inside in the deepest part of yourself and working with that. Which is what creates a presence here in this earth, this moment, this place, as opposed to that ever-ending expansion and beauty. You know, this in Buddhism, it's one of the key points is once you have gotten to nirvana, the job is then to come back and to work here and now while holding or while still being in that realm.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that because a long time ago, I used to look at, I was looking at hermetics, you know, this. A lot of the guys that were in that sort of field of study ended up like doing years and years of studying Franz Baden's work and then turning around saying, actually, Buddhism is the highest hermetic discipline because of that very reason. And I'm not saying like I'm not casting that Buddhism is the best thing ever or whatever. It's not, I don't have a view on that.
It's just, it's one of the paths that we can use to understand.
Yeah. It's like almost the highest. It's like the epitome of what hermeticism is. It's like, as you say, going really in, going up there and then coming back and working, but keeping hold of what you've learned. So, you know, in other words, you're not wiping it all clean and coming back with zero.
Exactly.
So that's super interesting. There is a tradition I trained with where they believe very much the same as like, obviously the same as the humans, that there is evolution in the planet. And with that evolution, there's an energetic evolution and that there are frequencies on the planet that are constantly downloaded and you can tap into those frequencies every few hundred years and work with those frequencies rather than relying on. So like this morning we did an hour of Qigong, Neigong, poor breathing work, Dan Tien assimilation. And it's, I like it because it's beautiful, right? Because it's like meditation and movement and breath and just being, but having fun with just being, where there are others that, they how can I say, they don't really want to do the work. They just want to have I don't know what I'm trying to say, but it's,
I think I do know what you're trying to say is often this is, there's two key words I find in a lot of people do this work is they look at transformation and transcendence, and I think most people are looking for transcendence. They think they're looking for transcendence. And that leads to two other terms is, one is what's called a spiritual bypass. In other words, you're connecting to the universe, what's greater, etc., without dealing with the emotional states of what's coming up. It's almost like if you connect to the universe, you don't have to deal with the emotions. Then leads to something else called spiritual materialism, where they're trying to accumulate as much spiritualism as they can, as it being an object that can be accumulated.
Yes, I actually had a client like that this week. And a super intelligent person, and that's their whole aim. He was on that realm of, as look at me, I've got this, and this, and it's like, wow. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I had a sense of one of a large amount of accumulation. But where's the wisdom? My question was, like, where is the wisdom for that?
And, you know, it goes back to one of the Buddhist terms, which is shempa, which is often translated into grasping and clinging. And when you notice grasping and clinging, the idea in shempa is to let go of grasping and clinging. The idea is that your hand should always be open.
Mm-hmm.
And often what a lot of people do is they accumulate all these spiritual practices, but then they're holding on to them.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And in some ways, you know, there are some spiritual systems that do incorporate working with the emotions that come up. Buddhism is one of them. Parts of Hinduism does it. Some of Taoism does it. But a lot of what is soul today and what is in the mainstream is all about be parts of the universe and that's it, without dealing with what emotions, what's really coming up for you inside and working through it. Because a great phrase, I think it's Michael Brown, who uses it almost always in his work, is the way out is through.
Mm-hmm.
It's not jumping over, it's not avoiding, it's going through what's there.
Mm. Mm. Reminds me of an interview I had when I was in my 20s for a debt recovery job. And the interview was like, you know, you have an obstacle in front of you and it's a wall. What do you do to, you know, navigate this obstacle? This was like the question in the interview. And I don't remember exactly because it's, mm-hmm. you know, 30 odd years ago, but it was this idea of, I just said, well, you know, look at the side. I kind of went through the logic. How high is the wall? How wide is the wall? Can you go over it? Can you go around it? Can you dig under it? And I think that was the epitome of what we are as humans, you know, avoidance. And there is that, like the conversation we had earlier was, being guided, like what guides you, and you know, are there inherent patterns that cause deviations in that guidance? And for some people, do they hit these brick walls, literally hit them, and not metaphorically speaking, you know, emotionally and mentally? And in some cases, yeah, maybe physical. You know, you hear these stories of people who they're supposed to get somewhere, they're supposed to go to a funeral, or a meeting, or a party, and they end up, you know, breaking their leg, getting on the bus or something. And it's like, was that an accident? You know, was it really an accident? You know, people say, oh, well, you know, my wife, when she came off a horse quite badly, it was there to slow her down. You know, this kind of
mm-hmm.
strange language that we use to describe these events. And then part of me thinks, well, there could be an element of truth to that, you know,
mm-hmm.
because what is the path that we're on?
Yeah,
we think of path as like a 2D, you know, like the path, my garden path. We think of it as a flat surface. But I think when we talk, you know, people are talking about 3D, 4D, 5D. Mm-hmm. Is our path multidimensional?
Well, I think there's that. And when we talk about the term path, often we go to Taoism because that's what Taoism means. It means the path, right? The Tao mm-hmm. is the path or the way.
Mm-hmm.
What's interesting is the term in Taoism that's used is not to follow the path, but to cultivate the path. And what does cultivation of a path differ from following a path? Following a path means that the path is there and you just have to walk along it. Cultivating means is that you're constantly creating the path as you're moving.
Mm.
Right? You're constantly engaged in the creation of the path itself.
Mm. Mm.
So we can still use this two or three dimensional version of there's a path, but every step is creating the path as you move forward.
Yeah.
Which means it might mean moving this tree, stepping on this branch. But the idea is to follow the flow of the universe as you create that path. And often, you know, there's a shamanic saying that I've heard before. I don't remember where I heard it. Was the universe first takes a little stick and starts to tap you on the shoulder to get you to follow the right path. If you don't listen, it starts to hit harder. Then it starts to tap you. Then it starts to beat you. And it will get all the way till it finally impales you until you actually listen to the path. So by not listening to the universe, one of the consequences of that can be death. If you don't listen, if you keep ignoring the universe.
It's interesting, you know, what, like I try to think in terms of our modern world where we're at and the things that we're exposed to. And often there are lessons right in front of us. Mm-hmm. When I think of Taoism lately, I've been thinking, I don't know if you watched The Mandalorian.
I haven't, no.
There is a character in that. I think it's Caliph or Caliph or whatever, it begins with K. It's played by Nick Nolte. And this character has spent a lifetime in servitude, you know, and with the promise of eventually having his freedom, and eventually he gets his freedom. And he's what we call a moisture farmer, so he's trying to gather water, you know, on a desert planet. But what I love about him is he has this element of like harshness, gratitude. He's been in servitude. He's now has an element of freedom. But whenever something happens, whether it's good or bad, he'll stand there and go, this is the way. And so for me, it's like the epitome of Taoism, you know. It's like, you know, one of the spaceships blows up or maybe one of the creatures they manage to capture or whatever. And he's like, yeah, this is the way. And I think that's the epitome of Taoism is, yes, there's an element of self-cultivation, either as a Taoist priest, right? So doing more of that sort of work, sort of the esoteric work, and they do a lot of calligraphy and prayer work and stuff like that. Or you're more like the alchemist, you know, the alchemy Taoist. So you're doing the internal martial arts or internal Neigong, Neidan practices with the idea of creating enough internal alchemy for the pathway to become apparent. But sometimes the pathway is just this is the way. This is the Tao. This is where we're at. I mean, I'm kind of, I don't favor any one thing. I'm just fascinated with it. You know, I'm almost fascinated with our need to have it.
That's true. One thing that you said that was interesting was this idea of freedom, right? So what does it mean to be free? Or you can even take that to the general philosophical question, does free will exist? So one of the things that I often say, and this is my material, is free will does exist, but not in the way that we think it does. For me, your freedom of choice or freedom of will is how much you are free to decide how much you resist the universe. That's our freedom. And once you let go of your desire to resist the universe, the idea of free will of yourself fades away. But ultimate freedom of being part of the universe comes into play. And it's almost like a paradoxical, is the more you attach to free will that I have the choice in what I do, the less free you are.
But yeah, you like paradoxes though.
Well, life is a paradox.
Yeah. It's like that image behind you, the Banksy one, you know, at a distance, it looks like you should be throwing a petrol bomb.
Cocktail.
Yeah.
It's actually very interesting. The story about this is that it was Banksy wrote it, created this. There was a manifestation. So there was a demonstration in front of a parliament in one of the Eastern European countries. But at the beginning, it wasn't a manifestation. It wasn't a demonstration. It was a rally to support the president. And one person, instead of starting to yell, long live the president, they started to yell, we deserve more from the president. And because everybody in the group who was there thought, well, if somebody's saying it, this must be what we're supposed to say. Mm. So they all started saying, we deserve more from the president. And that's what created the whole revolution to overthrow the regime. Hmm. So that's the idea of the demonstration, but by throwing flowers, it's actually more effective than the Molotov cocktail.
It also reminds me of the lead singer of the Smiths. Mm-hmm. And he used to come out on stage and throw flowers.
Yeah.
And it was like, you know, you're supposed to be this kind of band that's a little bit weary and a little bit sort of on the edge and how do I say? Not quite gothic, but you know, new agey, indie.
Yeah.
And then you're expecting them to come out and, like, you know, fuck the government and blah, and then is that throwing flowers? And it's just that, you know, I mean, Morrissey, you know, he's interesting character. But yeah, it's that paradox. I remember going to see Alice Cooper here in Dublin, well, in Dublin, in Ireland. And he was playing support act to a couple of other bands that myself and my wife wanted to see. And I thought, oh, here we go. But I tell you what, he blew everyone away. He was such the consummate professional. Mm-hmm. He's uber intelligent. He knew exactly what the political, at the time it was 2008 or 9 or something like that, and he knew the political ramifications that were going on in Ireland at the time. And he came dressed up like an American president, you know, with the big tall hat, this kind of image of, you know,
mm-hmm. Uncle Sam.
Yeah, Uncle Sam. But they had it all in the Irish flag colors instead. And people just, when this guy gets it, you know, mm-hmm. And without making a big song and a dance and riling up the crowd, he was just brilliant. He was absolutely brilliant. I would definitely go and see him again, but he could make political statements very cleverly about the country he was in. It's like, yeah. He came and he cared. He wasn't just showing up at the stadium and then singing. He was, what is it to be Irish? What does it mean to be living in Ireland? What's currently going on? How can I help them ease their pain? Very clever.
It's interesting that you mentioned the lead singer of the Smiths throwing the flowers. Mm. Is if you think back within the last 70 years, what was probably the most rebellious movement or the one that had the most impact on showing against the establishment, the one that was the most effective or the first, which have been the hippie movement in the 1960s.
Yeah.
It was all about flower power. So the idea of flowers being anti-establishment is very old.
Yeah. Yeah.
Even though, you know, so the whole idea of just, to give another antidote, this was back at I think it was the G7 or G8, I don't forget which number it was at that time, in Canada. Mm. One of the main acts of civil disobedience they did is they had a teddy bear catapult, where they were just throwing teddy bears from a catapult over the boundaries into the realm where all the ministers were.
Huh.
Right?
Yeah.
But often that's how revolutions, real revolutions, start. It's not through complete combat.
Yeah.
It's through civil disobedience and not, it's civil disobedience, but it's not conflictual.
Yes, not conflictual, yeah. There's a plethora of videos appearing on social media of people self-auditing government, especially in the UK, not so much in Ireland, but they're hanging outside police stations and videoing. And then invariably the police person comes out and starts saying, stop videoing, and mm-hmm. and it creates conflict. And I think this is partly a good thing and a bad thing, in that it's showing that actually we still have a lot of civil rights, but it could cause issues. It's a double-edged sword. I remember also here in Ireland, we had people, the whole BLM thing, and people were sitting down in the streets in America, and they were doing a little bit of that here. And I get the sit-down protests. I mean, sit-down protests like, I remember students doing it in my university when they were campaigning about, they were getting rid of grants and they were going to introduce a loan system in the UK. And I remember this girl, she stood up on the canteen table. She gave this amazing, rousing speech and like really firing everybody up. And we're going to go to the library and we're going to sit in the library all night. And, we're going to sit down and make a protest. And there's a guy just all the way through the thing, just eating his egg and chips. And he goes, well, just fucking sit down so I can finish my lunch, bitch. And it was just like, he was like working class student. And then this kind of like hyper well-educated activist. And I just thought, yeah, that's the thing, it's nice. And I see that here in Ireland when we had a lot of smaller sort of protests and the farmers, I think, here are the best for protesting. They just get in their tractors and drive into Dublin and cause traffic chaos, even more traffic chaos than there is. But at least they do something, and it's not never violent. It's all in good.
Yeah.
With a means to it. It is interesting. Also, we talk about the truckers in Canada and what they did. And I think there was an immediate crush on that, to crush mm-hmm. it. And to think the power of the ordinary person just rolling up in the truck and.
Well, there's an interesting moment right now with the fuel prices in the UK.
Hmm.
I don't know if you've seen this, but there's an association where they're trying to get, say, if we get 1 million people to sign on, none of us will pay our energy bills in October.
Yeah, I've seen this. Yeah. Yeah.
And those are the types of civil disobedience that actually are everyday people, doing their civil disobedience.
Mm.
And if we look at history, I think India is probably the best example. That was how Gandhi forced independence on the UK. It wasn't through armed uprising.
Mm.
It was through people who were suffering saying, we're going to limit our suffering.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's what promotes real change.
Yeah. It provokes me to think about what's going on in Europe at the moment and how events like what's going on currently and also what's happened previously, genuine or non-genuine, human created, non-human created, whatever, it can be leveraged for other gains. Friend of ours, a mutual friend of ours, Alan, is just back from two weeks in Portugal, and
mm-hmm.
A cappuccino and a muffin for €2.70. To have that in Ireland is probably €10. What's going on? And maybe €2.70 in Portugal is really expensive. I don't know, but my electric bill in the clinic is double. It's literally double overnight.
Yeah.
So what do we do? Do we just start mass non-payment? I don't know if Ireland would do that. You know, there's a level of social programming and conformity that's been going on for such a long time. But I do think if humans could pull together, in a, as you say, in a peaceful, intelligent way,
mm-hmm.
there's a reckoning that can occur. There's an awakening, or I don't really like the word awakening, but you know what I mean?
No. Yeah. I think everybody needs to reread David Thoreau's Civil Disobedience and to really understand what the idea is of civil disobedience.
Mm.
You know, that's.
Is it really disobedience, or is it like, for me, I sometimes see like this thing in the UK, I've seen it, I know what you're talking about. Is it more about just rejecting, not being disobedient, just.
Well, the term civil disobedience means being disobedient in a civil way. It means looking at where injustice is and standing up to it, but not in the overt aggressive way.
Mm.
Right. And it's in some ways it's taking charge of your own life for yourself, for who you are.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Which is interesting because there's also a huge part of, at the same time, seeing the way the world is and accepting it for what it is.
Mm-hmm.
Now that's a term that is often misunderstood because a lot of people think, if you accept it, it means you agree with it.
Mm-hmm.
But accepting, in this case, what I'm referring to is seeing it exactly for what it is and knowing that that's where it is.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Then you can respond to it as opposed to react to it.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess it comes down to this, is that a lot of the civil disobedience we're talking about is more a response to the situation than a reaction. You know, we always talk about this idea is that there's reactionaries.
Yeah.
But what we should be looking for is responsories. I don't know if that's a word.
Yeah.
But we should be moving away from the idea of reaction. Reaction means we're not thinking about our actions.
Mm.
We're just, an action happens to us and we react to it. Whereas response has the word pense in it.
Mm-hmm.
Pense comes from the French penser, which means to think. So our action is left by our integrating the situation and then thinking, and then action is coming.
And it's interesting because if we go back 200 or 300 years in history, in this current reality, it was more revolutionary.
Yes.
It was more of the fashion to be a revolutionary, which in a way garnered a lot more physical risk.
Yeah.
And I feel like they've been closing in on the revolutionaries, you know, closing in on them. Mm-hmm. So we have to be, as you say, more responsive, more intelligent.
We have to, what I would say, and this is going to go into a different content, but we have to stop reacting from the place of our collective trauma,
mm-hmm.
work on our collective trauma and start responding.
Mm-hmm. 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 Yeah. That's maybe part of our process of being here at this current mm-hmm. time frame, you know. It's interesting, clients that I talk to and treat, and as the last, more so this year, there's a very common thread. It's like, they'll say to me, is it just me or is the world getting crazier and crazier and more crazy things going on? And I'm like, well, I think it was always really crazy. It's just you're even more aware of actually how Like, again, you have to define what you mean by crazy, right? There's a definition around that. But I would almost say some things that are done are nonsensical or they don't make common sense. But there is this thing of people saying to me, like, what? I don't understand what's going on. You know, what is actually going on? Why is this happening? Why are we going through this? I always think of us sometimes as a baby in a carton having a tantrum, and we're trying to figure out as humans, like, where we fit in this.
Well, I think that we are at a trend. How would I say this? We're at a moment where there is a difference into the way that we would respond before. In as much as, if we think about on an individual level, we are becoming much more aware of the effects of trauma, of early childhood experiences, adverse childhood experiences, all of those types of things. And by doing that, we are also starting to recognize the same thing in our society. Right. So before, we wouldn't be the idea of understanding what happened before and the traumas that our parents lived through in generations. We're only now starting to realize that that has an effect on us. So at the same time, there's this beginning of understanding and seeing transgenerational trauma and personal trauma guiding how we react to the world. So we have, on one case, this awareness of our responsibility to get rid of this trauma or to work through this trauma. And on the other hand, we have a greater way of reproducing trauma through social media, through being more connected. And it's almost like these two things are coming together at the same time. In one way, you know, in psychology at least, there's been a huge shift within the last 20 years of looking at people's childhood experiences to describe and to understand how they're behaving as adults. And at the same time, we've had a huge impulse, or, you know, over the last 25 years, of just trying to change them based on their chemical makeups of their mind with drugs. So we're having these two separate things, and we can look at that also in society. You know, I think that's part of why, like, the Black Lives Movement, Black Lives Matter movement, is often about saying, this is our past trauma. We need to start dealing with it. And then there's a lot of pushing back against that, saying, no, we're just going to look at what's happening right now and deal with that. And there's those two different possibilities sort of colliding. And I think that's what gives a lot of people, it's very uncomfortable for a lot of people, because dealing with past trauma has many components to it, but two of the main ones are dealing with how I was traumatized and how I traumatized others. And it takes taking responsibility for our past actions. And that, you know, nobody wants to take responsibility. That's a general statement in life.
There's quite a lot of my clients have gone and done ayahuasca and, you know, these various interventions. Some of which have done it once or twice and got a lot from it. And others, it's almost like it's become the new addiction. They have to go every couple of months to do it. And it seems to me more and more as it's becoming, I mean, I thought maybe the popularity of ayahuasca would wane, you know, but it doesn't seem to be. Of course, on that side, you have the genuine article, and then you have the kind of the, what I call the plastic ayahuasca, where it's just, you know, a laptop and some guy cobbling it together in his kitchen and throwing it out there. And it's, it's interesting that at all levels it's becoming successful for a reason. And there's very few that I've met, people that I've met, there's a few that have said, yeah, we've been through it. It's eventually after 12 ceremonies that we realize you need to get someone who can do proper integration.
I think that's the key to it.
Yeah. But it took them that long to realize that integration was actually more important than taking the plant in a way.
Well, you know? How would I say this? Ayahuasca or any of these psychotropic drugs, psychedelics, you know, it's like opening a door to a different perception.
Hmm.
But just to see something doesn't help you integrate it.
Mm-hmm.
It's then working with those images, working with what came up, working with what that was showing you about yourself, and doing all the work after. And we go back to this idea of spiritual materialism, where a lot of people are just, I want to accumulate the experiences without doing the work. Right? So they're looking for transcendence. I'll keep doing it until I become perfect, as opposed to I might do it once, do it twice, and then work with what comes up.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the transformation. That's the alchemical process of what's there. But it's a business at the same time. So the business is getting people to come in and do the ceremony.
Yeah.
The follow-up business, or the follow-up part of that, is not very, it doesn't have the same business model. If you can get 30 people to come and do a ceremony for 2 days, 3 days, 4 days, they pay, they leave. The follow-up are on individual sessions, maybe group sessions, all of this type of stuff. That doesn't, it's not as cost effective. And most people don't have the skills to do the integration or that are doing the ceremonies. Now that's starting to change. There is a whole psychological group. You know, it's starting to be used by psychologists. It's starting to be used by integrators who are trained in not only doing the ceremony, but also the follow-up to the ceremony and working with the person for the next 6 months.
Yeah.
No. And that's one of the big problems with the psychedelic movement is that it's shown as that's, for me, that's the key part is the integration, not the ceremony itself.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, and if people are interested in that, the best person probably at the moment who's speaking about it is somebody like Gabor Mate, who is really working on the ceremony itself is one thing, but it's the integration and the working with it afterward that's the most important aspect of it.
Yeah, for sure.
In some ways, Qigong has that same aspect to it. And yoga should have that same aspect to it. If you're really going to work on it, it's doing the work, so it's doing the practice, but it's also then experimenting, experiencing, and working with the emotions that come out of it.
Sure.
You know, for example, today we were doing the internal work, and I was saying that I was getting this feeling, an emotion of, as I was coming closer into my center, I was starting to have this idea of being selfish or that I shouldn't be taking all this energy for myself. So now my work is over the next couple of weeks is to go back to that and work on it and understand that emotion. Because that's what the Qigong was for. It was to bring me in contact with that energy of myself to understand it.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas a lot of people will just have to do the Qigong. Oh, that was interesting. And then move on.
Well, it's super interesting you have that because there's something I didn't get a chance to. You're going to love this. You're going to love this. During that practice that we did together, we had to do some visualization, right? So we had to use our imagination And part of that's to visualize ourselves in this. We're not going to give the game away, but we're visualizing ourselves in a particular situation, working with that. And I couldn't visualize myself. So I was visualizing you. And so that, I didn't want to say that to you, but that, so I've saved it probably for the podcast, is I couldn't see me, but I could see you. So that always tells me where, when I'm training or teaching, where that person is at.
Mm-hmm. So what does it tell you about where I'm at, that you see me and not yourself?
Well, it just tells me that you were really focused on you.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I'm saying? So it's not that I couldn't think of myself. It's that your image was superimposed. So, okay. But I recognize, because 20 odd years of doing it, it's like, okay, there's a process occurring at both ends. So mm-hmm. it's like the recognition of seeing that I know that you are doing that. And then the realization of, because I've done that exercise 1,000 times, it's okay, Jonathan's there. But then I'm recognizing, well, you know, some part of me is integrating that as we're all one anyway. It doesn't really matter if I see Jonathan there or me there within that. It's, but so what I'm saying is, what one of the key aspects I learned from the Neigong teacher was, it's information. It's just information. It doesn't mean it's real. It's just, mm-hmm. if you see that happening, then it's only when you started to talk more about it, I was like, okay, I don't know if I should say this or not. But now it kind of makes sense now to say it, that you know, and the reason is, in the past I've said things and then, you know, the person's gone, no, I don't know what you're talking about. So, but it kind of makes sense to me now why your image was superimposed on me.
Mm-hmm.
It's nothing to do with strength or weakness or boundaries or
yeah.
It's just information and to what's going on in the whole process between us, not just what I'm doing and what you're doing. I'm sure within the shamanic realms, I'm pretty certain, having spoken to different shamans, that there are times when, you know, shaman will take a little bit, the student will take a little bit of plant, and then there's a shared experience.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it happens with people when they've taken LSD. A guy I went to university said there was 5 lads in the flat and they all took the same dose and they're all high pretty much at the same time. And they were just went through a whole gambit of emotions. And then they got to this point towards the end of the journey where they all started having shared experiences. And one guy was like a vegan, and most of the lads in the house weren't vegan. And he stood up and said, I've got to free the milk. We have to free the milk. And he said, like, the other 4 lads stood up and went, yes, free the milk. And he said, they all kind of like in this high state, marched into the kitchen, opened the fridge and started pouring the milk down the sink. And they're having this shared trip, the shared experience, the shared emotion. And so when I start to see, so obviously when I was working with that, I was expecting to see myself, you know, in that position, holding that posture, breathing in a certain way and condensing the breath. And I was like, okay, there's a mini John Shubbs there. What's he doing there? It's like, he's got one and I've got one. Where's mine? Where's the mini Anthony Monty? So then I go, okay, what are you going to do? Try to force it? Are you going to try to like replace that, or are you just gonna, okay, we're working with the mini John Shubbs? And so it's then afterwards, it still works. I mean, they still get an effect, but it's just, okay, there's an information pattern there.
So my question now is, how do you interpret that information, or what do you make from it?
I couldn't interpret it until afterwards. And then when you said, and you were talking about the emotion, I didn't, it's only now during this podcast, for some reason, it's come to me. Perhaps that's just information over about either where you were at, you know, like you're thinking very much about. I mean, I always look at the word self-ish. It's a little bit of the self.
Yeah.
We kind of equate selfish as a bad word. It's a nasty word. It's like, but really it's just itself and a little ish of it. So we should just say sometimes it's okay to be, you know, oh, you're so self-centered, Jonathan. Jesus Christ, you're so selfish. You're always so selfish. And it's like, well, what else is there?
Well, yeah, I think that's interesting. It's interesting when you just said self-centered. I guess the idea is to be centered without the self.
Well, I think to be centered without the self, you have to work on learning how to be self-centered.
Exactly. It's an interesting thing. It's first you have to be self-centered and then you can let go of the self. But so, you can't be centered without first being self-centered. It's a very interesting... but then it's also cultivating the self in a way that it will allow the self to fall away.
Right. So that's that five stages I was talking about. And I'm saying it's not the absolute way of doing it. It's a particular roadmap for the kind of practice. So we've worked over the last 2 years on structure, feeling fascia, feeling, you know, all of that, and then working with the mind and now working with the chi, and perhaps self-centered without self is the
fifth one. That would be the fifth one that neither of us have necessarily gotten to yet.
No, and maybe artificially we may have been there, but, you know.
I think that's one of the... Yeah, that's one of the things that we often forget is people often have this idea is there's an ultimate goal of I want to be, you know, I want to become fully awakened or a realized individual or all this. But when you look at the literature and the people who might have gone through this process, it always seems as a never-ending process, is that there isn't a moment where you can say, oh, I've succeeded. Right. There might be milestones that you accomplish throughout the system, but there's not a moment where it stops.
Yeah, that's very particularly true of Neigong, I can say for sure. I think Qigong, it's a modernized word, you know. I think if you go looking for an end goal, you're going to be disappointed. You know, you're going to be... Like, I mean, we had this conversation a few weeks ago. I remember, like, where would you like to be? And I, you know, I am fascinated with what super certain humans can do within that realm of internal work. And they do have exceptional feats, but would you want to live that life? And at nearly 50, you just are where you are, and it's learning to be content. And there's a part of me I can definitely say that still has discontent. It's an interesting word. Discontent. So it's like without content. So I'm going to spend the next X amount of time here working on finding, it's like when you said to me, what have you been doing for the last 3 months or 4 months? You know, because we hadn't had much chance to chat. Yeah. I've just been training with a goal. No, just train, just training. Yeah. And that for me is very different to my previous life, which was, you know, working towards the black belt, getting the first dan, second dan, senior dans, whatever it was.
Yeah.
And we liked that. I posted a thing there about
that feeds our egoistic approach of saying of accumulation, right? That's accumulation.
Yes. It goes back to the beginning of this podcast. Is that a spiritual accumulation? Is it a materialistic? Is it?
Accumulation is always materialistic in some sort.
Hmm.
Right. That's one of those links that as soon as you're trying to accumulate something, you're trying to hold on to matter. Whereas it could be spiritual materialism, it could be accomplishment materialism, it could be physical materialism, monetary materialism. All of those things are about accumulating something.
Yeah.
Yeah. And as you were saying, is that this was the first time you were training for the fact of training itself, not to get somewhere.
Yeah. Well, it was the first time in a while. I wouldn't say it was the first time ever, but it was the first time in a while. It was just, you know, training. Like I do remember in the beginning of like doing that sort of stuff, it was like, I wanted to get to that point. I remember in the beginning, I wanted to stand, be able to stand for an hour and a half. Like I'm going to, and you know, the clock and each month would go by and then I'd be at 45 minutes. And I used to like get to like 45 and 50 minutes of standing and jam-jong and thinking, I can't go any further. I can't go any further. And then the mind started, then it started to become about the mind, you know? And then I spoke to a friend of mine who practices Yi Chuan. It's like a type of boxing, and they do a lot of standing and they sometimes do 3 hours a day. And I said, like, what's the point in standing so long? Like there's a law of diminishing returns, you know, because he said, actually you're right. He said, they stand for 3 hours a day in China for this martial art. He said, but to be honest with you, the first hour is physical and the last 2 hours is just for the mind, you know? And so I learned as the years went by, quality, you know, 20 minutes of high quality consistently has far greater returns for me personally in this current working environment, home environment, as a therapist environment, than trying to go for like as much as possible. Because I've done it, I've tried it, and yeah, it's super interesting. And yeah, you do get very interesting, shall I say, downloads or pieces of information or insights, or you could liken it to shamanic work or whatever. Mm-hmm. It is fascinating. But the beauty of like what we're doing is that it's like riding a bicycle. Once you get into that rhythm of doing it, you never have to go back. You know, there's never this thing of having to restart, which I felt in the martial arts, like I've been years out of it now. Going back to do it's like, oh, you know, it's there, there's sparks, but you have to relearn, which I never felt that with Qigong, Neigong. I felt that once it's there, the flow and the movement and the breath just stays with you. It's integrated. But we are definitely goal orientated. You know, there was a situation I remember in the UK where there's these Korean masters stepping off the planes, you know, and they were second dan in Korea and fifth dan in the UK. And they pretty much got three dans just on that 14-hour flight. You know, this idea of, you know, the black belt was in the suitcase, you know. And we do go down that route. I mean, I advertised recently for a course that I'm going to be teaching next year in Tweener, and I get a lot of inquiries. And the first thing is like, they don't go, oh yeah. And they want to know straight away, when's the intermediate, when's the advanced? I'm like, hold on a minute. We've not even begun training and you're already, you know, qualified. So I tend to just not engage in that and say, look, let's see how you are first with your foundational work, you know? And it's a little frustrating for them because they like structure.
Well, I think that's also a lot of people come in specifically, I want to get rid of my pain. That's the main reason that people come for treatment.
Mm.
So as a practitioner, it's very difficult to balance that idea of, okay, they have a chief complaint. They have a reason for being there that we want to work with.
Mm.
And at the same time, one of our my main goal is, it's not that I want you, this is again a Michael Brown statement, but I think it's very appropriate, is it's not that I want you to feel good. I want you to get good at feeling.
Mm-hmm.
Because as we get good at feeling, then we can understand in it, there's something there for us to learn about.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that is one of the, I think, the main problems in treatments, is that a lot of people are too concerned about getting a result and not concerned enough about doing the process.
Yeah. And also accepting that the process for some people is longer or shorter.
And it's longer, and there's you know, it comes back to doing the work.
Yeah.
You know, as you work more in therapeutic work, I'm sure you've seen the same thing, or I imagine you have, is that you become less interested in, you realize that the symptom that the person comes in for is not the real work that needs to be done. That's just the entry point into the person. That's the entry point of where you're starting from.
Mm. Yeah. I had this discussion the other day with a student, which was, you're going to get clients coming to the clinic who will say, oh, you know, general stress, generally tired, a little bit burnt out, whatever. And then invariably they'll even write that down on their intake form or whatever. And then 20 minutes in, it's like, well, actually I'm here for fertility. Oh, okay. You know, and that may be more to do with the social elements of that and to remain confidential and secret about it. And that's fine. That's all good. And then there'll be some people you come, like I've had some very interesting, very unusual cases recently, more so than ever. And yeah, it's, as a therapist, you do realize, oh, especially when you're doing like work on yourself, you start to go, okay, this person's come in with, say, a stroke recovery, and you go back through the journey of how the stroke started and where they were at and what they were doing, and you're like, okay, wow, you know, wow, there's a lot going on. It's not just wanting to come out of the stroke. There's a whole life story there.
Yeah.
And there's an underlying emotions that you can see are not being handled. And I say to the students, you've got to look at, you know, you could be a pain specialist, you could be a fertility specialist, you could be a MS, ME recovery specialist, fibromyalgia, whatever, but you still got to look at, you will start to notice the root cause isn't just dysfunction of certain organs. There can be, there's a much, I'd say even beyond the root cause. Do you understand what I'm saying?
I would say is that, you know, from a TCM perspective or a Chinese medicine perspective, we look at the zongfu, so the organ, right? We're trying to work with the organs. Again, that's just a context and a framework in which to navigate and to understand the person behind it. It's not the... It's a contextual, or it's a framework in which you can enter into the person, but you're not really treating the organ itself. You're treating the human being, the person there who has that organ.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it becomes easier in treatment at the beginning, at least, to focus on the organ, because that's something that you can work with. So you've been able to develop that understanding of this organ is just a representation or an archetype in which this is where the person is stuck.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know,
yeah.
In the UAT system, we always start with the fundamentals of understanding the interactions of the channels, and we start with treating pain.
Yeah.
And at the same time, that's an introduction into, because we're treating pain through interactions in the system, as opposed to just focusing on where the pain is, it's creating something a bit different. And it's bringing the practitioner into an understanding of how to treat the holistic aspect, as opposed to just treating the symptom, which would be much more, you know, local treatments, things like that, or just treating the symptom. As soon as you start bringing in systems, you start bringing in the whole person. Then you start to develop a knowledge or an understanding of what's going on below it.
Yeah, I agree. Having worked with other systems and trying to then figure out, you know, some of the knowledge base around that, and you know, a question arose for me is, where does this ease start, like being not at ease. And you're correct. It is, as you say, Zhang Fu, five element, whatever it is, pulse diagnosis. It's giving a structural content or context to, as you say, to gain entry. There is a teacher of mine in Turkey who does the kind of a cranial osteopathy system, but it's actually more than that. And it's completely just spiritual. It's all treating the spirit and spiritual aspects and miscommunications between various spiritual aspects of ourselves. And I'm using the word spiritual and in a non-religious sense. It's fascinating to me. It's fascinating to me now that, you know, we talked about deeper self, higher self today. I remember asking Master Leo, it's like, where does the illness start with one of the systems he was teaching? And he's like, it starts from up here. You know, why does that person have ME or does it have MS? And it's, sort of, it's always from up here down, you know. And then it's like, as a young man trying to go, huh? You know, what's he talking about? How can it be up there? You know, and then now, you know, you sort of go, okay, maybe a lot of the stuff that you could argue is that rooted in is he talking pre-heaven? You know, is he talking even more deeper than that in terms of there's a dysfunction with our original source energy? And is there a dysfunction with our higher self and the disease is manifesting within us in the physical realm? You know, blah, 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 blah. I mean, I always think of our kids, you know, when our kids are playing their PlayStations and mm-hmm. have a connector and we are the character in the simulation and our real self is the person driving it. And perhaps the person and that driving real self is a bit stoned, I've been drinking beer and I'm all over the place today. My higher self is not concentrating.
But that reminds me of a story. This was often told by Carl Jung, C.J. Jung. It was called The Medicine Man, and it was his idea of the ultimate therapy. So this is a story that is often told in Chinese, it's a Chinese parable. There was a village that had a huge drought. For many months, it had no rain. And the villagers kept asking, you know, they did everything. And then finally, they asked this one man, this medicine man, to come and help them. So he walks into the village and he looks in the village and he says, okay, I'll be in here. And he goes into a hut. And he just sits there for about 3 weeks. He doesn't eat. He doesn't sleep. He just sits in the hut. And then he comes out of the hut and starts to rain. And the village asked him, what did you do? And he says, well, when I came into the village, I saw that everything was in disarray. Nothing was right in the village. So I sat in the hut and I put myself in order. I went through everything that was in myself that was out of order. And once I was in order, the village became in order and started to rain. And that's the goal, according to Jung, of therapy, is to put the self in such order that the universe around you starts to flow properly. And that is, I've often kept that is one of the goals of our ASIS therapies, is to help people on that journey to put themselves into order.
Mm. Yeah, I like that. I like that idea.
Knowing that we can't put them in order, but we can be the hut that contains them.
Mm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
We can be the place where they can feel safe to start to put themselves in order.
Mm.
Mm-hmm. And as practitioners, it also is imperative that we do the same work on ourselves.
Yeah. That's why I really like where I'm at the moment personally with my own training, is because that element has always been there from a very beginning, in terms of when I was learning first to work with energy and my first teacher would say to me, like, who do you think's doing the work here? Who's really doing the work, you know?
Yeah.
And that's stayed with me for many years. Who's really doing the healing here? Do you think it's you? Do you really think it's you? You know, and he used to always come up when I used to do a lot more cranial work and energy healing work, and he used to come up and literally like slap you or hit you with the back of the head and go, and he'd say, get out of your mind. You're in the mind. Yeah. You're trying to heal with your mind. And it's like, detach from the outcome. The most powerful healings you get is when you're not there. And he used to say to me, like when I was doing the work, is imagine you're holding the person and you're working with them, and then get on your motorbike in your mind and go for a drive down the country lane and enjoy that, what that's like, or get on a boat and sail the boat. Detach. And it was true whenever I did energy work, and I'd be present, but not focused in on like, I must move this bone or I must move what you hear. And yet then there is now, you're seeing, and I am seeing, and maybe you're seeing it too, is there's these crowds emerging out of the Neigong Qigong world where they're like, you must compress the chi into the Dantian and you must like rotate it and fire it out. And many years ago, I thought that's where I needed to be. I needed to be the Jedi, you know. But you try doing that when you're in a field with 40 people that need to heal. Fucking ain't going to happen, dude. You know, no matter how good your chi is, you're not going to go around every single person and inject them with chi. And plus then you're defeating the whole, yeah, it's great intervention. And
you're not helping the person on their process.
Exactly. But it's good for them to experience what is possible as a human being, if that's part of the process for that human being. But isn't it far better, like Wang Cheng Jiang said to me, 1,500 people a day at the lake, standing there doing the China universe, opening and closing the lotus flower. He said, I'm doing nothing. They're all bouncing off one another, creating a field of energy.
Well, this comes back to one of the main points that I, especially when I talk about the four needle five element technique and we're doing the abdominal palpation, one of the statements I often talk about is one of my goals is to take the practitioner out of the treatment.
Mm-hmm.
Is to allow the system itself to heal the patient,
mm-hmm.
and to step away from the idea of you need to diagnose, you need to understand, and mm-hmm. you need to know exactly what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the human body is the most complex entity that we can find in the world,
mm-hmm.
in the material world.
Mm-hmm.
It would be extremely presumptuous of us to know that we can understand it.
Yeah.
What we can do is we can follow the guidelines of the patient's body. And if we're able to listen to what it's telling us, just follow what it wants without us imposing this, or this.
Sure.
And that's a very similar idea, is that we need to be able to remove ourselves from the treatment. We want the practitioner to almost just be a facilitator for the patient healing himself. The practitioner never heals the patient.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, definitely. On that note, coming back, a Dickie Bird tells me there's another book coming out very shortly.
There is. It will come out on the 21st. That's
my wedding anniversary, so I can celebrate. I said to my wife, there's your wedding anniversary present. I'll probably just go joking. Brilliant. So this is really the progression of where we were from Sun Season of Channel. So
this is your model. Exactly. So the Sun Seasons of Channels was the introduction to my vision of Chinese medicine in the basic form. So we looked at yin yang theory, five elements theory, and then mainly the channels, why they were where they were on the body and how we can understand them. This book has the same characters. So Sun is returning to see the grandparents for the second summer. And it's told in the same context of the tea ceremony, you know, doing the afternoon tea. And in this book, the grandparents are teaching son about how and why the channels interact. So it goes through the ideas of imaging mirroring or holography in Chinese medicine,
mm-hmm.
right? So this is taking into account the idea of as above, so below, sure. and then how we can find within one part of the body, the whole body. And then it goes into understanding the channel interaction. So why, if I use one channel, will this have an effect on another channel? We go through the six systems to do that. And to understand that, we create what's called the unified acupuncture theory model, which sort of is the basis for us to navigate those interactions.
Sure.
And then
it's definitely having an impact because, as you know, a couple of days ago, this chap flew all the way to America mm-hmm. and looking for you. Whatever situation, it doesn't really matter. Yeah. And I remember after having the interaction with Dallas, if you're watching or listening, he's in Kilkenny. It's only half an hour away from here, so we might get a chance to catch him today. But he's so impressed with, because he's an engineer, right? Mm-hmm. And then went into acupuncture, it's having an impact, you know. Sometimes you don't realize, you know, for someone to want to come and learn directly, and I'm sure we will meet him. And I said to him, I have a really strong feeling this is not over. And I think I told him straight away, get this book, the next one is coming. And I feel there's two edges to this book, which is it could blow the doors open, but it's going to invite also curiosity. Do you know, it's going to invite that curiosity to want to find out how can I implement it?
Yeah. So I think the book will be very good. It's within this idea of channel interactions and holography. There are a couple of other books out there, but in my opinion, they're not as clear or well-constructed. Well, of course, I'm going to say that it's my book.
Yeah.
But it's also one of the things that I really attach to with these books is that it's told as a story. It's not, you know, it's not this top down, do this, do that, do this.
Yeah.
It's told in a conversation. So it becomes more accessible and it becomes more, it's something that you can actually interact with.
Yes. Adventure.
It's an adventure. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
Which I think is an important aspect in learning is that you get into the interaction with it and you become part of it. It's not it's not like this didactic, do that. It's conversational.
It feels to me like as if the story is almost how a family would have sparked that curiosity in their child. Exactly. Several years later, the child says, you know, maybe I could come and be your apprentice and work with you, whether it's an uncle, a mother, an auntie.
Yeah. It's the way it would be passed down from generation to generation. It's the traditional way of learning about the world.
Yeah. And it's interesting. One of the Neigong guys that I follow, Master Yap, he talks about, you know, never really wanting to do what his dad and his uncle were teaching. It's like, yeah, kind of doing it because it's kind of expected of you. And he said, it's then when he got to 18, he was like, oh yeah. Yeah. I really, really, I'm here. I really want to do this, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Because he was taught, it's like, so instead of him being in a temple and hidden away from society and doing it in that sort of Shaolin manner, it was done through family interaction, questioning, answers, work with that, look at this, go away, think about that, form your opinions.
And also it forces him to be in both worlds at the same time. You know, the person who does this in the monastery and is shut off from the world can get very good at understanding the system, implementing on themselves.
Yeah.
You know, but we still live in a world where people go out into they have jobs, they have families. And as a practitioner, if we don't take that into account and try to meet the person in the world that they're in, it can be very complicated.
Sure. So to bring this podcast to a conclusion, for those of you who've reached the end of this and have managed to get through it, Jonathan will be back in the new year. Dates to be finalized, hopefully by tonight, Jonathan. Actually, I just need to sit down with my diary and have a look. Because obviously Ireland is a small country and very much influenced by weekends and holidays and stuff. So I'd be really interested to see how things unfold in October following this book. I definitely will be pushing and promoting it here in Ireland just because I think it's necessary.
Yeah.
It may be the step that people need to think outside of the realms of where they've been.
The other thing is that you have both books that they can get off the website. Is that correct?
I don't have the other book yet. I know she's going to send them to me, but we'll organize that anyway for the other. There's like close to 30 UAT students in Ireland, so we'll see. I mean, obviously, they're going to be the first people that we'll reach out to once we're ready to go. But I would like to then obviously keep people abreast of what's going on next year. I know you're going to be teaching again in Chiwe.
Yes. Chiwe, there's also going to be a course in Berlin. Poland.
Yes. Are you going back to Poland or?
Probably. I'm still waiting on the dates again for Poland. That's still something that's going to come up.
So if anyone's listening to this, you know, in the internet, web, YouTube, whatever it is, it's on whatever platform I've put it out there on, you don't need to wait to come to Ireland. He's there in Europe. So, I do feel a very strong sense after today's training that the next book has to be something completely out there. really,
you're not the first one to tell me that there's going to be a big change in what's coming out.
It's coming. I can feel it. Like even today, even the interaction, even the way that you're sat, you know, it's like you're you're in the Zen moment. So let's see what gets created in the new year. Thanks to everyone for making it this far through the podcast. I didn't do an intro because we were in the middle of vibing and I just said, right, we've got to record this because it's like slippery fish. They go through the net if you don't catch it. So we needed to catch that moment. Thanks for being with us. Thanks to Jonathan. He is probably the most common guest or the most frequent guest on my very small but humble podcast. But it's good to do these because if I don't, I won't get done and we won't. We're now into episode 20-something, wherever we're at. Stay tuned. Let's see what happens. And I will drop any details relevant below to Jonathan's work, links to anything coming up as we go on. Thanks for listening. Thanks for joining.
Thank you.
See you soon.